Good afternoon, everyone.
Good afternoon.
How's our volume? All right. I hope everybody is enjoying their GA. I hope everybody is still relatively alert, not getting the glazed over look quite yet. Thank you for coming. This is the Visible and Invisible in Ministry workshop. I am Mary Bernard. I'm the editorial director of Skinner House Books, which is the UUA's UU publishing imprint, and I'm very happy to introduce this workshop. So this project came about because Skinner House Books, in collaboration with the UUA's Multicultural Growth and Witness Office, put out a request for proposals. We were looking for resources that were really going to move Unitarian Universalism in the direction of greater, more authentic, more vibrant multiculturalism. And we got a couple of really great proposals that are going to turn into books. And this is one of them. And we were particularly excited about this one because, A, it gave us a chance to work with the UUMA, the UU Ministers Association's Committee on Ministry for Anti-Racism, Anti-Oppression, and Multiculturalism. But also really because this is an unusual book in the sense that it actually really foregrounds the experiences of people of color. Instead of being a book about the white experience of trying to be a multicultural congregation, this is from the people of color perspective, and that is really important. So we were very excited, and I'm going to introduce Mitra, who's going to introduce the panel. So Mitra Ranama, the Reverend Mitra Ranama, currently serves as minister of the UU Church of Long Beach in California, and she is a member of the Committee on Ministry for Anti-Racism, Anti-Oppression, and Multiculturalism.
Hello. So I'm going to talk really briefly about the idea around, behind this book, and then we're going to hear from some of the writers in the book. Oftentimes, ministers are the most visible and the most invisible in the room. And I say that because we hold this space that is reflecting back the communities in which we serve or are in relationship with in some way. And we also have a deep inner life that sometimes can or has to be set aside in some ways in order to help do the work that we want to do. It is also true that oftentimes people of color are the most visible and the most invisible in the room. And so then when you layer those two things on top of each other, things get real complicated in this really beautiful and rich way. So we wanted to be able to have people tell stories and to talk about that experience. Being a person of color in leadership within a culturally white community context presents itself with many unique challenges. Then leading from what we call this sort of historical marginalized place, there's not a lot of resources that delve into that idea. A lot of times when we talk about multicultural education, it assumes that the person who's in a position of power, in the institutional place of power, is white, reaching out to people of color. There is not really any resources or conversation happening around the person in the place of institutional power as being a person of color serving primarily or culturally white communities. And so we thought there needs to be conversation about that because it's happening. So that's the thought behind the book. What we did was we put a call out for writers, and the design is basically there are 9 chapter writers and there are 9 respondents to each one of those chapters. And we got a great response, which was really exciting. After we had the people selected and the drafts written, we brought everybody together for a conference. This was maybe a year ago, I think.
October.
So we had a conference where we did a reading. And people read the chapters and the respondents, and then we had conversation. We recorded that conversation. So that is also going to be in the book. So the design is the chapter respondent and the conversation from that. And so this is our sort of first time kind of going public with some of that work that people have created. And we're recreating that today with two of our chapter writers and two of our respondents reading excerpts from their work. So what we're going to do is we're going to have them read. We'll have Derek read his excerpt from his chapter. Lily is the respondent. Summer will read her chapter. Bill is a respondent. And then we'll take questions after all of those readings. So if you have readings, if you have questions as you go along, jot them down and just take notes. And then we'll do questions and have dialogue afterwards. I'd ask you when you come forward to just say where you're located, and I think we can go ahead and get started. So Derek's going to come on up first.
Hello. I am Derek Jackson. I am the Director of Contextual Ministry at Meadville Lombard Theological School. In the wake of Ferguson and the Black Lives Matter movement, I have found my Unitarian Universalist identity and my African American identity at odds with one another. Though this is not the first time this has happened, these events have brought to light my struggle with being in a faith that is sympathetic to my identity as a person of color, but just does not get it. I attended a vigil for Michael Brown, hosted by one of our congregations. We stood outside holding candles and sang songs of justice. We went back inside and all of the ministers processed. And we listened to prayers and reflections from ministers in the community, UU and otherwise. As I looked out at the sea of mostly white faces, I felt alone and isolated, instead of drawn into the community. It was clear to me that my UU community was looking at this issue from a distance. They were supporting justice for the other. And in that moment, they saw me only as UU. They saw the police violence as something that happened to other people. Michael Brown did not represent their brother, their son, their nephew, their cousin. They were outraged about the injustice. I was feeling the pain of my people. And there was no space to name that pain in my community, in my UU community, at least not with people who would understand. I did not need a sympathetic ear. I needed someone who could understand my pain and could help me find solace in our UU faith. But that was work that I needed to do on my own. And it required resources outside of our UU faith and grounded in the African American tradition. And so I wonder, if I cannot find the resources for spiritual development within our faith, how am I expected to effectively minister as a person of color? I became a Unitarian Universalist because I had long been a Universalist, but did not know that there was a religious home for my beliefs. And yet I still go back to the spirit of the African Methodist Episcopal Church from which I was raised. I often ache for the music that makes my heart soar, that brings the divine present in the room during worship. I miss ministry that is grounded in and speaks to my Black identity. I miss a message of hope that is grounded in an understanding of struggle. I miss all of these things, and yet theologically, I could be nowhere else. And so I make my home here in Unitarian Universalism, as imperfect as it is, and find ways to stay grounded, to stay connected, and to stay whole. Growing up in the AME Church, I was presented with images of spirituality that were grounded in my Black identity. The worship service and religious education both reference Black history and Black identity. I learned how my cultural struggle and my identity interfaced with the biblical narrative. When I became Unitarian Universalist, it was clear that my history and my culture was not reflected in worship and religious education. I could connect on the level of my humanity, but my identity was rarely represented. Often, it only appeared on special days, Martin Luther King Day, Black History Month, Kwanzaa. In those moments, I felt other. I felt as if my culture was being put on display and not an inclusive part of the service. It is hard to engage UUs with these areas where I feel disconnect from UU culture. I often struggle with how to say something or if it is worth it. I worry about the other person's reaction and if I have the energy to deal with it. There have been many times when I have engaged someone in conversation and the conversation quickly turns to them, how they feel about it, how they are not to blame. And instead of engaging the issue, I am engaging their needs. I minister to them pastorally instead of prophetically. Tied into this is my own struggle with wanting to engage in multicultural ministry because it is important, not because I am a person of color. Because of this, I prefer to engage people that I know well, who I know will not respond defensively. And I struggle with this because the line between avoiding conflict and self-care seems very narrow in these situations. As a minister, I try to find ways to create for others what I have found missing in Unitarian Universalism. I incorporate people of color voices in worship throughout the year, not just on special occasions or topics. As much as I can, I try to engage the body and the heart as well as the mind. And I am conscious of creating spaces for connection and engagement in worship instead of stillness and isolation. And I try to be attentive to the experiences of my seminarians of color as they find their ministerial path. As a community minister, I was intentional about finding a worshiping community that addressed as many of my concerns of the broader UU culture as possible. And having a minister who is a person of color has been extremely helpful in sustaining me so that I can be effectively ministered to as I minister to others. We all have to find our resources and supports so that we can minister effectively as people of color. At this point, our needs are broader than the faith can provide. But I hope that we can live into our stated dreams and be a faith that is open to diversity and more than word, but in deed. And I am able to bring my full self, my full spiritual worshiping self, into our faith.
My name is Lilia Cuervo. My last appointment was associate minister at the First Parish in Cambridge, Massachusetts. I must add, I was the first woman and a Latina at that being installed as a parish minister after 366 years of Harvard boys. Derek opens his chapter by writing, "These events had brought to light my struggle with being in a faith that is sympathetic to my identity as a person of color, but just does not get it. Since I arrived in the United States, I have tried to understand the disconnect between the images I had both about myself and this adopted country and what my experience had been. The gap between our being sympathetic to those identities of persons of color and getting it could be attributed to the fact that since its birth in America, to this day, the Unitarian Universalist culture has reflected the nation's culture to a capital T. And that is precisely what makes it very difficult to bridge the gap. The following seem to me to be important points of convergence and fusion between those two cultures. The sense of exceptionalism and of aggrandized self as a nation rooted in ignorance, resulting in disregard of and disdain of other nations and cultures. Similarly, Unitarian Universalists continue living the myth that we as a whole enjoy a superior socioeconomic status, including class, wealth, and education. This prevents us from doing justice to the many among us who don't fit that myth. It also prevents us from meeting and inviting the other to our exclusive clan. We view missionary churches with contempt and find no need to share our UU gospel. The culture of dominance and entitlement reflected in the top-down influence. We do whatever possible, including invading other countries, to institute our own brand of democracy and to extract whatever we want from them. We Unitarian Universalists practice top-down social justice by doing for others instead of with others, such as inviting them to our religious home and or participating in worship and social justice work in their midst. The demographic configuration, country of immigrants, of outcasts, of pioneers. Like our country, our denomination is one of immigrants, albeit from other faith traditions. The invitation, "Give me your theologically abused, the traditionally oppressed, the spiritually homeless," aptly describes our intention to be the liberal religion that not only welcomes, but gladly accepts those who cannot find a home somewhere else. Unfortunately, as in the country, our welcome and acceptance is preferential of those like us, and our collective experience has taught us that to succeed in this denomination, persons of color, and I would say ministers of color in particular, need to display strong survival abilities to endure microaggression, bullying, and disrespectful challenges to our authority. This is a double pity, given that what has made our country, since its birth, one of the greatest in the world, is precisely its rich mix of all kinds of peoples, cultures, and religions. It does not take much to realize that our Unitarian elitism, both cultural and theological, born and rooted in the halls of Harvard, has been detrimental to our growth and to our democratic vision of being one faith that is open, compassionate, and accepting of all. I need some water. Additionally, with the highest degree of miscegenation. Miscegenation enjoyed by the free world, there are millions of individuals who inhabit a rich and empowering mixture of cultures, including religion, skin colors, and other physical and psychological traits. To dismiss their richness and to label them different and inferior to us in the name of the despicable racist one drop of blood rule is one of the most short-sighted and non-spiritual attitudes our denomination can have. Freedom of expression, which, when taken to extreme, as often done by religious fundamentalists, leads to dogmatism and hurt. We claim to detest dogma, yet we are capable of acting and speaking in self-righteous and chastising manner. In this church, we don't wear that, usually a cross or another religious symbol. Or here in this fellowship or society, when we don't say the G word, or we don't like pagan rituals. Federalism that fractions the unity of the country and makes it very difficult to offer in all the states of the Union an even distribution of goods and services from education and work to justice and health. Unitarian Universalist congregational polity, as I understand it, makes it extremely unlikely that we adopt a core belief and that we choose to preach a similar gospel of hope and redemption in all our congregations. A confusing manifestation of our polity is the variety of names adopted by our congregations to indicate their theology or lack of it: society, church, parish, congregation, fellowship. I witnessed the hurtful treatment accorded to a newcomer by an indignant old-timer who scolded him for the use of the word church, since this word offended the humanist and the Jewish people among us. Our congregational polity has resulted in a disjointed emphasis on what, in my view, should be the spiritual and the pastoral mission among our congregations. Many a times, individuals seeking spiritual depth are lucky if their local church offers that which they seek. Although dissatisfied with what they experience on Sunday worship, many people keep attending because that is the only liberal religious place in town. Derek expresses a similar sentiment when he writes, "I miss all of these things, and yet theologically I can be nowhere else." The concept of self-reliance, intended to inspire and encourage the insecure and the timid, which can lead to blame and despair. In the context of our religious body, self-reliance can deter the soul from seeking union with and strength from the mystery, can make one shy away from the benefits of praising and petitionary prayer. Many a Unitarian Universalist minister has found his or her theology of self-reliance lacking in compassion when most needed at the bedside of the dying and in the presence of the depressed, for example. Derek's following lament seems to confirm the sense of isolation our Unitarian Universalist faith with its penchant for self-reliance can bring. He says, "They were outraged about the injustice. I was feeling the pain of my people. But that was work that I needed to do on my own, and it required resources outside our Unitarian Universalist faith and grounded in African American tradition." In the richest country in the world, a prevailing culture of scarcity reflected in tight budgets for projects that will benefit the most needed. This culture of scarcity also pervades the great majority of our congregations, even those with millionaire budgets or endowments and assets devote unusual amounts of time to discuss budgets based on fear of scarcity, limiting the reach they could have. after all these years of immersion in the Unitarian Universalist culture, little by little, I internalize detachment from my Judeo-Christian roots. I also learn to ignore the culture of ignoring my spiritual ancestors, very much as it was persistently modeled by many ordained and lay church leaders. After a major epiphany, though, regarding that loss, I have been discovering anew the riches and comfort of my roots and culture, along with the teaching and examples of our Unitarian Universalist spiritual teachers. I believe that the gap between sympathy and getting it is magnified by the fact that the Unitarian Universalist faith has tried to be open to all, pleasing to all, believers and not believers alike, so to speak. In the process, its spiritual and theological roots have been compromised for the most part by secular and rational thought, to the point that there is not a clear understanding of the secular goals and of the religious vision and mission of the church. Somehow we ended up substituting emphasis on social justice that benefits and satisfies, for the most part, mostly whites, for emphasis on what should be the truly inclusive, multicultural, anti-racist, prophetic and visionary voice and deeds of our church. Unless we religious leaders decide to extricate this faith from its pervading secularism, we will continue paying lip service to our wish for spiritual growth and real transformation. We are called to use our prophetic and pastoral voices from the pulpit and from everywhere there is an opportunity to preach the Unitarian Universalist gospel. If we do not get serious about living and preaching that gospel, we will be unable to provide true religious homes that would cater to the spiritual and emotional needs of thousand seekers, many of them people of color. In time, the difference between the religious spiritual institution we claim to be and a non-profit and benevolent society will increasingly blur. Unless we courageously use our prophetic, compassionate, and healing voices to attract and keep newcomers and old-timers well-nurtured spiritually and emotionally, our congregation will continue being proverbial revolving doors. I got this idea today, that these are different. We try to emulate, or we are immersed in this culture, but there is something good that is happening now, which is the similarity with what is happening in the political arena. We both, the nation and our denomination, might have a woman president, so that's not bad.
Good afternoon. My name is Summer Elbeati, and I serve as minister at the UU Fellowship of Kern County in Bakersfield, California. In 1991, the United States invaded Iraq. At that time, I was in college. Stories of Saddam Hussein terrorizing Iraqis flooded the Arab American community as justification for invasion was sought. The day of the invasion rocked my world. I mourned with my friends in the Arab American Association, and I held my father, who ached with a deep pain, having never returned to his homeland since he arrived on our shores in 1956. And I witnessed a gradual change take place in me as I heard threats that we Arab Muslim Americans would be put into internment camps, just like the Japanese Americans. I feared what would happen to my family. We discussed whether my brother and myself, American-born, would be included in these camps.
We worried about how we would survive. We wondered which neighbors would take us in and which ones would put the mark on our door to let everyone know that the enemy lived there. I watched and listened as members of the community came together to share their own stories of pain. I listened as Arab Muslims disappeared from our communities. And I realized that no longer were we considered Americans anymore. We were truly the other, and it was institutionalized. And I would say that these experiences became even more pronounced as we fought a war on terrorism. And so no longer was I another Arab American, bicultural, multicultural, Muslim woman interested in allowing people to get away with being racist. I became another who would speak out more against the injustices that my community faced. I realized that if I was to be a part of this oppressed community, I would need to be a part of liberating the oppressor by teaching those from the dominant culture about their own inherent racism. Unbeknownst to me, these feelings served as a first calling to a life of ministry. I felt a need to serve by working toward justice, but I did not know how I would do so. With this newfound courage, I experienced even more racism than before. As I would speak out, I became known as an Arab and Muslim, and yet I felt a tension within between wanting to hide my identity and wanting to fight for justice. But something pulled me into a way of life of continually speaking out against oppression, this divine experience known as God in Islam has a way of reminding you to be your authentic self. Of course, with authenticity and standing up for justice in oppressed peoples comes more hatred and racism than ever experienced before. But since social justice brought me to Unitarian Universalism, I wonder how to deal with the daily messages that we ministers of color are not quite up to par if we do not participate in risky behaviors that some of our white colleagues can and do participate in. How can I live out that promise that we Unitarian Universalist ministers preach about without risking experiences such as getting arrested? And how do I live with the unintentional shame when members of the congregation I serve risk getting arrested for a social justice cause that they believe in when I have visions of Guantanamo, internment camps, white supremacist police, and risking not being able to protect my family? How do I explain that these visions keep haunting me and prohibit me from participating in such a noble experience with members of my congregation? How do I express my deep sorrow at choosing to work for justice in a less radical way when all I want to do is feel free enough to have that choice to behave in such a radical act of love? The pain is real. And when asked where I am, it is my prayer that you will remember that I'm a minister with some protection, yes. But when I'm targeted and searched at yet another airport because I carry the proud name of my Iraqi ancestors, I'm not just a minister, but another human, hoping and believing that someday we shall overcome. And even as tears form in my eyes because I know my light skin did not provide that protective layer once again. Many of us sing the well-known verses, "Come, come, whoever you are, wanderer, worshiper, lover of leaving. Ours is no caravan of despair. Come, yet again come." These lines probably inform a theology that was taught to me by my father. That is, there is a concept of forgiveness and love infused in those lines. God or the beloved will love you even though you're not perfect and make mistakes and leave yet again. The beloved awaits you with hope, not despair. And there are 99 names for the beloved, but the ones most spoken on the lips of Muslims are Rahman, or merciful, forgiving, and Rahim, or compassionate, loving. And so it is with these concepts that I must ask how we, a beloved association of congregations, show compassion and truly love the other. Forgiving ourselves, being merciful upon ourselves as God is merciful with us when we fall short. My late Iraqi Muslim father taught me this concept of forgiveness by saying, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, but if you forgive, God will forgive you. This concept of forgiveness was big in our home. I learned that God will forgive me when I forgive others. This is an aspect of the beloved that I've taken into my ministry. And I have to remember that through the growing pains of working through centuries of learned hatred towards Arabs and Muslims, our beloved communities and association must be forgiven. If I forgive, God will forgive me. If I forgive you, I can forgive myself. And yet, since 2001, the interest in Islam has increased as we all watched a vicious terrorist act upon American soil. And if one were to ask any Muslim on the street, they would probably agree that this was not the act of Muslims, but terrorists. And yet, the Arab Americans in particular, Arab American Muslim women versus Christians, have become the focus of search and rescue missions as we liberate them from the oppressive husbands and fathers. There is a race to become the hero and rescue the Arab American Muslim woman from herself. But as a minister of color and a woman, and certainly as an Arab American Muslim woman, I had no need to be rescued. The only rescuing needed was from my own thoughts of anger and hatred toward those who were victims of a system that teaches white is better than the other. My only rescuer was the beloved. And belief in working for justice as an act of working for God was and is how I get through when experiencing yet another racist comment within our congregations. Sabr wa iman means patience and faith in Arabic. It is with this Islamic concept that I'm able to work steadfastly toward our beloved community. But as a minister and a woman of faith, I ask myself every day, In the face of these experiences and statistics that show hate crimes towards Arab and Muslims have increased since 9/11, and in the face of historically racist images in the West being placed on screens across America, what can I do to help this beautiful liberal faith of mine learn to truly embrace and love the other? How do I help let go the thousands of years of programming about the particular other known as the Arab Muslim? And as a minister who lives in a culture that vilifies the Iraqi other, both cultures a part of me, two countries of which I am a part and that have been at war for most of my life, how do I help our congregations to learn that their beliefs may not be their own and may be an orchestrated plan so that they support a war on terror against their beloved minister's family? Yes, my family. The minister's family that has fled their homeland, housing the Garden of Eden and Noah's Ark and the birth of Abraham. My family who lived in a country that is known as the cradle of civilization, in which the first writing and literature, mathematics, astronomy, and laws were formed. The minister's family lives as refugees, and every Iraqi American, every Arab American, every Muslim immigrant who has seen the effects of war lives within this liminal state of hopelessness and hope as we witness hearts change within the Americas and beyond at the same time that wars on terrorism continue. Sabr wa iman, patience and faith. Keep the faith. And I stand here boldly declaring that I am the face that we have learned to fear. And I am a Unitarian Universalist minister, and I don't need salvation from oppression. I'm present and strong and a spiritual leader, leading Unitarian Universalists to save themselves from many years of cultivated fears of the other. I'm here to help our denomination recognize that our country holds beliefs that have been perfectly orchestrated to allow for occupation of other lands in the name of heroism. And as a minister, I'm not perfect. I fail every day. But I must look within when I live out the stereotypes taught to me by a culture that has an interest in perpetuating stereotypes. And I play a part in continuing the stereotype when I do not do the work of transforming my soul to one of love and acceptance and forgiveness. And so I wonder, how can our congregations become sanctuaries of freedom and hope? How can we free the chains that bind us and keep us from truly living our principles? We have something beautiful that cannot be found on the streets of a culture that continues to vilify Arabs and Muslims to this day. I believe that if there is a denomination that can succeed in creating a multicultural denomination, it is Unitarian Universalism. We have a faith of committed people who continue to grow and move beyond, and I believe our congregations will learn to embrace the other in such a profound way that we will end up liberating ourselves over and over again. And we just might enjoy some good food, too. Thank you.
Bill Sinkford, and I serve as senior minister of the First Unitarian Church of Portland, Oregon. And it was both a great privilege and a real challenge to respond to Summer's writing. Some elements of her story have similarities with my story, and similar experience makes connection easier, but some elements of her story are quite different from my experience. There's richness in those differences, but there's also challenge. The term ministers of color embraces a much wider range of identity and lived experience than was the case than we could even imagine 25 years ago. And the cultural context spanned greater range as well. But the African American experience still dominates the narrative within the liberal community. Though how long that will be the case is an open question. The Latino community, which I'm learning to call the Latinx community, by the numbers is larger today, and it is more bicultural and bilingual, the oppression less evident, perhaps. As an African American, I know that the well-educated, liberal, white congregants to whom I minister share a basic orientation to me and the racial identity that I represent. It is an orientation that dances around a guilt, or at least a responsibility, for slavery and the oppression of African Americans in this country. Even if it's rejected as a personal guilt or responsibility, there is a knowing that oppression was visited on my people by their people that operates in the background and grants me, in some strange and unearned kind of way, a moral authority which is unearned by me, but granted by you. The reaction of liberal white UUs to Latino ministers and Native American ministers, Japanese and Chinese American ministers, Hindu and other ministers, carries some of the same charge of responsibility for mistreatment by the white majority in this country. I believe that the liberal white reaction to an Arab and Muslim UU minister may function without that charge of guilt or even sense of responsibility. Because guilt is so much a part of the reaction I have received, I'm not at all sure dynamically what ministry would look like without it. In subtle ways, that guilt or sense of responsibility has granted me an unearned moral authority. On what source of moral authority could an Arab Muslim UU minister rely? Could white congregants justify a claim of innocence and resist appeals to responsibility? Would it be easier or more difficult for them to stretch to understand and to know their minister? Because of the way our culture has made terrorists of all Muslims and Arabs generally, the white culture can wear the mantle of innocence with greater comfort than they can in relationship to any of the other racial or cultural identity groups that we, the U.S., have oppressed. Perhaps I resonated most with Summer's story when it highlighted the concern she must hold that need never trouble our white colleagues. Her concerns, being seen as a terrorist, are somewhat different from mine. I know that my white congregants do not share the anxiety I feel when approached by a white police officer, and they never will. The experience of living with dual realities in Summer's story seems very familiar, however. And though she does not name it, I wonder if the danger of forgetting that we are seen as other is not part of the struggle. Does she get surprised sometimes when she realizes that she is being seen as an Arab Muslim woman minister when she thought she was just serving as a minister? Being out about who we are means different things and brings different dangers for ministers of color. That is something that Summer and I share. She writes, I learned that though light-skinned and thus able to pass for white, I no longer passed once out with who I was and what I stood for. But here again, differences are present. In my own family, passing as white was the goal. My birth certificate says that I am white. That was seen as protection for me, I am sure, by my parents, who themselves were passing as white in California when I was born. Being out, meaning to embrace my identity, has had many benefits for me. Affirmative action in college and early corporate job placements, in seminary scholarships, and perhaps my rapid rise to denominational leadership. That affirmative action does not apply for Arab and Muslim UU ministers. Embracing my heritage closed off few options, and no options that call to me. Embracing her heritage and identity for Summer clearly cuts off the comfort that would have been hers by identifying with the white majority culture, by passing. The experience of passing, I think, carries with it a guilt born of betrayal of who we are and a constant fear of being outed. A ministry of authenticity seems so difficult when conducted from the closet. The beloved, to use Summer's language, would call constantly for honesty, troubling the spirit. The ministry of identity has been one of our faith strengths. Our witness and work on LGBTQ issues and marriage equality has helped define us for a couple of decades. But identities are complex and multifaceted creations. In the hierarchy of privilege and oppression, most of us experience some of both. In the politics of power and oppression in the U.S., I have always been a second-class citizen, even when I was benefiting from affirmative action. I've never had a safe haven to lose. I remember so well realizing that in one day, September 11th, 2001, African Americans ceased to be seen as the most dangerous people in America. But I greeted that change with only sadness and no relief. Adding one more group that must struggle for acceptance and empowerment is not a cause for celebration. And I remember every day that the beloved community will be incomplete until we can sing, come, come, whoever you are, and mean at least all those who are called to our ministry.
So now we want to open up for those who have questions or comments. Our writers are going to stay at the table and use the mics. There's a microphone here. If you're able to use it, that would be great. If not, you can say the question and I'll repeat it in the microphone.
I'm Jay Clemmy from Worcester, Ohio. I'm going to be daring with questions because if there's anyone who's benefited from more kinds of privilege than I have, it's probably the only piece is that I'm here and not more Christian identity. The hope piece is that having grown up with the family story of my dad's German-speaking congregation with yellow paint thrown all over it in 1917 in north central Iowa, and growing up with a name straight out of German dictionary that brought some flack when I was, you know, a young child, it has pretty much been erased. I think probably the white skin has helped it go away more easily than other challenges, but those challenges are there. The question I have about religion is, to my friends who are gay, I would not be one of those who thinks that they could pretend to be straight. as someone who could probably fake believing in God, but it would be very inauthentic, the question of whether I belong in UU has been there for 20 years, of whether we really do have one of the poles that holds up the tent that welcomes people who are not God-believing. And am I lying if I call myself religious and then religious UU here?
I'm not sure if there was a question there, but I... Derek, that's for you. Did you catch that?
Yes.
Okay, great.
So I think as I put in my chapter, what I was really trying to get out of that piece was looking at the sense of worship and spirituality that I grew up with that fed me. I wasn't able to find that represented in Unitarian Universalism. It wasn't necessarily a question on whether there was a place for those who are religious or is not, but really thinking about there are many different ways in which we engage our spirituality. And I find, and there's actually more in the chapter that I've been engaged in that wasn't brought in this piece, but I find that there is a disconnect in most UU worship, and you know, some churches are different, but there is a much more disconnect between the head and the heart and the soul. And there are people who need different aspects of it. And sometimes you can't actually, when you have a need for that deep spiritual peace, some places, congregations aren't there for that. And then there are some congregations that might not be responding to the intellectual. I was responding for what I needed. I have not found it to be able to pull that piece as deeply as I need in Unitarian Universalism. And sometimes I've actually gotten resistance when I've tried to use that in my own worship style to be able to engage in that, what I find that feeds me as a minister and a minister of color. Does that help answer?
Please.
I like the tunnel phrase that Bill Sinkford, Reverend Bill Sinkford had, which is that you have been given authority, I'm paraphrasing here, that you haven't earned. It brings to mind a question that I've always had in my mind. I think when you are given something, you don't feel that you have earned. Or at a more modest level, when you make a faux pas and people act as if you had said something profound. To me, at a deep level, that's a form of rejection. In your experience, do you think that we will ever overcome that easy route and get to the point where people feel that we are really a community, that we are so integrated that if I interact with somebody, I'll be judged by the authenticity of what I say rather than my skin color?
Thank you for the question, Gus. So when I preached the other night, I said I didn't pretend to have any answers. But there are a few things that I think, and one of the things is that there's no way to the beloved community except through the complexity. You just have to go through it, and a significant part of the work is not mine around race. It's for the white community to do. But around transgender issues, a significant part of the work to do is mine. And around issues of what it means to be an Arab Muslim woman minister. A significant part of that work to do is, my point is that we need to have a more embracing understanding of the complexity of identities that doesn't look at a person with darker skin and say, oh, you're African American, because that person could be African, or that person could be Caribbean, or that person could be a dark-skinned Colombian. So that you need to be able to show up ready to hear the complexities of the story, not needing to read it only at the primer level. Is that a helpful response, Gus?
Hi, I'm Michael Hornsby. I'm from Albany, New York. Reverend Sinkford, your words challenged me this afternoon, and I was sitting back there, and I was wondering. It was the phrase that you said, the sentence that you said about after 9/11, blacks were not considered the most dangerous people in America. I'm going to respectfully disagree. I think that because of the subsequent police shootings of young African American men and all of that, I think that a more accurate, if I can say that respectfully, way of looking at it would be that another group has been added to dangerous people in the U.S., and that was Arabs. But I don't think that African Americans are considered any less dangerous. I mean, I didn't feel any safer after 9/11. You know what I mean? Walking down the street and all of that. Yeah. So I do have a question for the panel, and it's have any of you ever felt like any of the whites in your congregations have refused to be ministered by you, or they delegitimized your ministerial authority?
Yeah. That's a good question, because I think it's something that we struggle with all the time, in that you could be at, let's say, a board meeting, right? And that's a complex relationship in and of itself. And you speak, and yet three people will talk over you and say, you know, yeah, that's not, and sort of, you know, throw away what you were saying. And you have the choice. Do I take that moment to affirm and say, no, you misunderstood what I was saying? Let me say it again in another way. Or do you sit back and say, okay, I'll give them that one? When you see that repeatedly occurring, you start to say, there's something else going on here. And then you may speak out more. That's been some of sort of like the experiences that I think I have had that sort of speak to that question, that yes, you can experience that. That sort of, you know, be quiet now because we're the board and we're talking, you know.
The answer is absolutely. But it manifests not in, I've not had anyone refuse ministerial services, but the character of the services shifts. And so the one story I was going to tell that came up immediately, we're in the middle of a transition in our music program at First Unitarian in Portland. We're looking for a new minister of music or music director after a 39-year run by our last guy, who did a wonderful, great program. You know, so how should I respond when a congregant asks me whether we're going to move to gospel music as the dominant mode?
I consider that everything we do, even washing dishes, could be pastoral, could be ministry. So when I dare to challenge the budget or the way the money was distributed or not expend, I was really humiliated. Who are you to talk about budgets? You probably don't understand anything about that. I was forbidden from preaching about certain subject because a person decided that I was not qualified after having gone to the web and searched if I had experience in that subject. The person didn't know that, yes, a lot of experience, but that's the kind of thing that, and it's hard to say that it was not a congregant, well, it was a congregant who said, complained and wrote a big email to the senior who then proceeded to tell me, you cannot preach on that. And where was the freedom of pulpit, right? Mm-hmm. But, yes. And many other, you know, slides and things that happen. For some people, I was too light, and so I was not really a person of color to serve the congregation. They were looking for a real person of color. For others, I was too dark, and therefore, you know, second-class citizen. There are many ways where you feel. You try not to pay attention to that because or else you go crazy. But some affronts, some microaggressions, they're not so micro. They can be really macro, you know. So, but it happens.
This is a question to the panel. Are there some things that can be part of the internship process that could help a new minister as you're navigating some of these issues? I know that when I supervised an intern who was a person of color, I realized that some of my own strategies might not work. There was a certain dimension of I can take racism off the table when someone's interrupting me at the board meeting or doing something, but another person can't and needs to unpack that and talk about it. So if you have any insight about internships as a way of leading to a more positive integration into the ministry, I would love to hear it.
This is something that I've actually been thinking quite a bit as that is my portfolio at Meadville and thinking about how to really support our seminaries of color in their internships. And one of the key pieces, I think, for those who are supervising students of color is for your own, doing your own work around the issues and to really sit there and really look at, so, okay, where's the role that I need to be able to be as an ally for the student and to know that that is going to be part of your role as well, because there may be moments where you're going to need to run interference through some interaction that is nothing about the student as themselves and their ability, but about some of the racial overtones that are helping that are underneath all of that. So having that awareness of that part of your role is going to need to be as an ally, to be able to really look at a situation and say, okay, what is that about? And how to really help support that student. And to not, I think another is that awareness that to not expect that they are going to have a similar experience as you. And to really be very sensitive that there are things that are going to happen to them and they're going to have to engage with that you have never faced and you will never face in your ministry. And so to be open to really exploring and engaging that with them to kind of say, oh, okay, what is this? And how can I support and create this to be a safe space for you? How can you have this conversation when things happen in the receiving line and those things happen when a comment is said to the student? So really, really thinking about what are the really things that might happen and being really ready to have those deep conversations. And it also could help with the sense of having a mentor of color available for the student and being able to be that, because there are places where they're not going to be able to have that support and that you might not be able to support them in that way.
We have a few more minutes here and then I'll go right there. I see you.
Okay. Hi. I have a question. And when I in listening to what you all talked about, I was so struck by the fierceness and the sadness. And my question is really about Unitarian Universalism and what we can do about that. You're all part of and work with congregations, but the congregations are, at times they're out on their own. But we're also part of this association, and the association has ideas and resources that sometimes are beyond what a single congregation could do. And in listening to the three candidates for the next presidency, all of them talked about the need for anti-oppression work and multiculturalism. What would you like to see the next president do to make the association stronger, more responsive to the issues that you all talk about, and to help the congregations who sometimes take a brave step and they think they're doing a good thing and they think they're ready, but they may need more support to be partners with you in your ministry?
Thank you. Does anyone have an answer?
I would say the most important thing that anybody can do in the congregations, in the denomination as a whole, in the country is education, to become savvy on multiculturalism, on anti-racism, on all these things that are very, very important if we are going to live in beloved community. Because many, many of the problems that we have, many of the hurts that are inflicted upon us or we inflict upon others is because ignorance. We don't know the cultures, we don't know the nuances. And I would say education is the most important thing. And also, you know, go to the spiritual place where you come from compassion, from acceptance. It's compassion. We are all children of the same ground of being, and we said so much, you know, to be open and to be accepting, but we are really not, because we have not done the internal, interior spiritual work. We are champions of social justice, but social justice, like I said, from top down or very spastic. You know, we go excited about this project, and then when the leader changes into another project, everything falls apart. So we have to be more consistent, and we have to come from that place of spirituality. Without spirituality, without that grounding in the mystery, without grounding in that is larger than us, we become shallow and we become very, very inconsistent. That's my opinion.
Thank you. What, your last question, I'll repeat it in the mic.
Oh, I was going to answer.
It may have been answered. It'll take me forever to get over here. Just go ahead and say it. We only have 2 more minutes.
You may want.
I think you probably answered the last point, that we have created the problem for them, that they don't need to solve it. More education for the intern isn't quite the answer. We're the ones that need to do the work of learning how to be more appropriately engaged. And neither is it only the UUA's role to do that. We know that we're way behind in how we treat differences and learn about it, but we're the ones that we need to do the learning so that we're not creating the problems that you have faced.
Thank you.
So I just want to, and I'll, I guess, respond to that and the previous question. We need to put more persons of color in leadership roles within your congregations, within the wider denomination. That needs to happen. We can do all of the internal work and studying anti-oppression and anti-racism, but if it's not coming out in terms of going, wow, oh yeah, time and time again, we keep hearing, put people on the board, put people in leadership roles. They need to be in leadership roles. If you're not internalizing that and making that happen in your congregations and across our denomination, and really looking to persons of color to lead us into a multicultural movement, right, of faith, then we're going to keep being stuck. So.
Yeah. I have something I'm going to say.
So what she said, and I said before that the only way to where we want to get is through. More of our congregations need to have a culture where it is not only okay, but expected that everyone, not just the minister of color, will be asking the question, well, how does race and culture play into what just happened? How did that impact what just occurred? So that you make it the way we do things around here to always be asking that question. And you'll learn, promise me, you'll learn so much if you start asking it.
Thank you. I agree. I want to say one other thing that I'm noticing. This book is a paradigm shift in how we do anti-racism and anti-oppression work, which means, and the paradigm shift is decentering whiteness, which is actually often at the center of the conversation. What is the white experience of doing anti-racism work? And then the nature of this is decentering that and putting people of color's experiences. What is so interesting is that it is so embedded into our thinking, and it was even when we had the conference and all of the folks of color came together, that in our conversation, we have quickly recentered whiteness. What is it that our congregations, who are supposedly white, right, can do? We've recentered that. And I just want us to take notice of that, because we have to retrain our brains a little bit around that. And I think that's really important. And the irony is that people of color do it too. It's not, it's just the way that when we had a room full of people of color who center anti-racism work in their lives, the conversation still turned to talking about white folks. So I think it's interesting that we need to think about how is it that we are allowing leadership from the margins and shifting our brain. I just want to really encourage that, because I think we've done a little bit of that here. And other than that, I want to thank our writers, and thank you all for coming very much.
Yeah. by 6 p.m. For me, it's kind of fulfillment of my calling. This is what I was called to do. I just took that 20-year detour at the UUA. I would say it's what I've known from Jeremy. It is really about being able to create space for people wherever they are. I think that for too long in history of our faith, we have never there's been much debate.
Well, there's a disagreement about that.
I believe in the high head factors of humanists, or I believe in the anthropology of search of theology. But I can't say we are greater than one understanding of the spiritual, and whether it's something divine, or whether it's just a respect for humanity, or whatever it is that comes on the side of us, in Christ, but that it's not to us. And the fact that it is, as the saints were and it may mean that
it could be worse.
I have a theological ministry and you don't, and yet we still can be here. And that's kind of and it means that there may be some.
I know I do it in
I may be able to be at a certain way that we now have in the gathering. I want to have the opportunity to have one.
That's good to see.
And if we can see both. And be willing to sit there and appreciate the diversity of the commercials. I think it's supposed to get places that we can.
How are you?
And I think that is, and I think that is what caused the So when I talk about it wasn't about the state of the it's about my essentially and universal that when I have tried to engage in this process and there wasn't even the space where I was at for that to have even some of that in that space or to be acknowledged that this isn't you're doing something experimental and not having to be in the universal somewhere trying to do something body and it was more in the chapter that kind of goes into that
but
it's like that actually going to a little bit more about that just doing body ownership or what I suspect is to feel even and I think it's sometimes it goes beyond. So I know it's not and somewhere in the world, that's because even then, when there's not a space for what you know, and be able to do what I want is opportunities that there are many ways that we can express and to be able to do all of them, and not to be able to either try to find something just in the center and there's only what we do, but allow the fullness and breadth of our how all this works. That is really where I am.
So do you know that the metaphor of the inviter and